Hello, Wangs. Welcome to the special bonus members episode of The Rest is History. And today, Dominic, today is an exciting day, isn't it? Today is a day of sporting tension.
It is. Do you know what, Tom? Have you ever been to Las Vegas?
No, but I imagine it's very like this.
I think this is Caesar's Palace, you know, 5 minutes before the big fight. All the big names are in the audience. Sean Penn, Ted Valance, Nadine Dorries, the tension rising,
yes.
The music pumping.
Yeah, Paulet. They're all there, all the gang.
John Morrell. And the atmosphere electric because... So the weird thing about doing a podcast, obviously, even more, I think, than doing things we've done for the BBC, radio programs or TV, is that you're very much opening yourself, you're selling yourself to the public, aren't you? And because we do it through Twitter, that means that with every episode, we get tons of feedback, not just people on the Discord, but we get feedback from people who say, well, that was a load of rubbish. Actually, they don't normally say that was a load of rubbish.
No, normally people are very nice.
But there's always been one or two outliers. There have always been one or two outliers, right?
But Dominic, the weird thing is that we've done a number of episodes where we've thought, you know, we might...
Yeah.
So the communism one, I would have said. The fascism one, we...
Got no grief at all for them.
A certain degree of nervousness about that. Definitely the Mohammed one.
Well, I mean, that...
You know, I don't think there was a single joke in that entire episode.
Shocking.
A single moment of levity.
There were no, you didn't do your impersonations then?
No, there were no impersonations in that episode. It honestly never crossed my mind that... that the episode that would kind of generate the blowback would be one on the trial and execution of Charles I. But we should have been warned because prior to that, we did, of course, the World Cup of Kings and Queens. And again, we thought a relatively uncontroversial spread of Kings and Queens. We did it with Tracy Borman. The three of us got together.
There's a little bit of negotiating, wasn't there, about
the 16? A little bit of negotiations, yes.
Final 16.
Whether Knut should be in it, whether George III should be in it. So, yeah, so there was a bit. But again, we didn't think that people would feel strongly enough about it to unleash a Twitter tornado, basically.
A tirade, I think is the word.
Which is what we got from someone whose handle is Kapil Loft. And Kapil Loft's response to the World Cup of Kings and Queens. Bizarre list. What sort of World Cup of Kings and Queens excludes Henry III, Charles I, and George III? I mean, come on, George III was the longest serving monarch until Victoria and Liz II came along. Instead, endless samey medieval kings plus Cromwell, who wasn't even a king.
It's called Kings and Queens World Cup, not Heads of State World Cup. Oliver Cromwell needs to be airbrushed out. The man was an evil, vile aberration.
And vile is a word that will be reappearing again. And Kapil Loft set up his own, I'm afraid to say, very, I thought, gerrymandered.
It was
World
gerrymandered.
Because basically, he was the only person voting in it.
No, I think there were a handful of other people, Tom. Be reasonable. Be fair. But
there were hundreds. Yes.
Okay, well, that
you could probably...
Kapil Loft, who we've got chained up in the room next door, and he's trying to break in to the Rest is History Towers before his time, which is kind of example of his intemperance. Anyway, so then we went on to do this episode on Charles I. And we got in our mutual friend, Ted Valance. Very distinguished figure, is he not, Dominic? So, I mean, give us a sense of how distinguished Ted is.
I knew Ted, first met Ted 29 years ago when we were history undergraduates together. He went on to do a PhD in the politics of the 1640s and 1650s. He's the world expert, I believe, on oaths and the swearing of oaths in the early modern period. We actually taught together at the University of Sheffield for a few years. And he is professor at the University of Roehampton and head of the graduate school there. And he's writing a book about the trial and execution of Charles I. But I think merely the appearance of his name was enough to, well, I think it was the subject matter that got Kapil Loft fervently hoping that it will not besmirch the memory of that great Christian martyr was his reaction to news of the episode.
Yes.
And then, of course, it all went horribly wrong from there, didn't it?
So Kapil Loft, I mean, basically, he went apeshit. First on Twitter, and this is to you, Dominic. It pains me that a fan of Baldwin and Joe Chamberlain can be so wrong on 17th century politics, though at least you're not quite as dead to all morality and decency as that hellhound Valance.
Yeah, strong words. But,
and then he took to the Discord. I just started to listen to the episodes on the trial of Charles, King and Martyr, but frankly stopped after 5 minutes to have one frankly cartoonish and utterly biased apologist for Puritan tyranny, regicide and murder, Ted Valance, one self-confessed pro-regicide admirer of Cromwell, that's you, Dominic.
It is.
And one fence-sitter, that's
fence
me.
Fence-sitter, Tom, come yes, on.
I know.
He's now got you.
The centrist dad of the 17th century. As the panel discussing it means that any fair account is clearly impossible, and I won't dignify this travesty with my time.
But to be fair to him, he did try to dignify the travesty with his time, because he went back on Twitter. He then said, I just made a second attempt to listen to the rest of his history, but once again had to stop in anger. Every lazy bit of long since debunked Puritan and Whig propaganda is trotted out without challenge. Falsehood and half-truth abound. Vile.
Yes, so there's that word again.
Yeah.
So... Dominic, we've said this on the advert that we put out on the Vikings episode that went out yesterday. We do not shrink from criticism.
No, we welcome it, in fact. Well, I don't welcome
it. Well, I don't think we welcome it. No. We'd really rather not have it.
Yeah, that's right.
But if we do have to have it, we are happy to respond to it. And so, as I said, we have Kapil Loft. We've brought him in chains, obviously, because he does have a tendency to run amok. But we're going to let him in now. And in he comes wearing his battered, shabby wig. He has a copy of Icon Basilicae in his frock coat peeping out. Kapil Loft, welcome.
Welcome to the rest of history.
Hello. I feel after that intro, I'm already been somewhat demonized. And I think all good institutions need that gadfly to keep them honest. So yeah. I'm hoping that I can play that role.
The John Wilkes of the rest of history.
You can't call him John Wilkes. Although
Nigel Farage.
John Wilkes was a pornographer and a deeply impious man, so I resent the comparison to Wilkes.
Okay.
And a wig. And actually, I mean, so wiggery is your great target. You've accused both Dominic and me of arrant wiggery, like Dr. Johnson. Sir, I perceive you are a vile wig. But Kapil Loft is, of course, not your real name. I don't think we're giving anything away there. But it was the name of a wig, wasn't it? So what's going on there? Is there actually some kind of weird split personality at the heart of your Twitter identity?
Yes. Well, in another life, I wrote a PhD on the 18th century. And I did some work, and Kapil Loft came up. He was a Whig lawyer. In the late 18th, early 19th century, and a rather an eccentric figure. I chose him as my Twitter handle because it's such a memorable and odd name, Kapil yeah. Loft. It's unique. Nobody is ever going to have that name, and I hope it kind of sticks in people's minds. But yes, now you know, so to some extent, my political views have slightly changed, and it now it kind of hangs around me a little, you know, hangs around my neck. But I have considered changing it to Dr. Sacheverell or some other more sound person. But I think once you've kind of established yourself, changing your name on Twitter is not a good idea. So I'm kind of stuck with it now.
And before we get into the sort of the nuts and bolts of the fight, the Charles the First issue. So what is it about the early modern period and the politics, the sort of Whig Tory politics, the Hanoverian succession, the rival sides in the Civil War and so on? What is it about all that that gets your juices flowing so with such kind of such passion, would you say?
Well, I think, you know, that you have those kind of political compasses that will have things like authoritarian versus libertarian, left versus right. I've always thought that really there should be an axis for Cavalier versus Puritan. So I think it's still, to this day, one of the key kind of axes upon which the way we think about not only history, but also contemporary politics hinges. I mean, we still think of politicians in terms of being Cavaliers or Puritans, and we still have the legacy of a kind of moralistic Puritan kind of approach to politics hangs over contemporary politics. So I think it never really goes away. I think in some ways, you know, that historical juncture of the 17th century is the point where you still feel very passionately that, you know, whether you'd be like a Cavalier with an excellent hat and a righteous attitude towards Episcopal authority, or you are some kind of deranged regicide who wants to smash everything up and has no respect for the arts or culture. Not that I'm biased,
but you say you say deranged. I mean, in contemporary recent British politics, those who account themselves the heirs of the Puritan tradition, the Leveller tradition, the regicidal tradition, would include some very prominent figures in the Labour Party. probably less so in the Conservative Party.
Yeah.
But you yourself, I don't think I'm betraying any confidences here, have been a Labour councillor.
Yes, I have. My argument would be that historically, the relationship between... the way that people think about English history is that if you're a kind of rationalist who believes in smashing everything up, who believes in progressive reform...
I love the link from being a rationalist to the first thing a rationalist believes is smashing everything up.
Well, subjecting everything, all existing institutions to kind of relentless scrutiny based on abstract reason, if you like. There's a view that kind of rationalism and individualism and kind of materialism and atheism necessarily is associated with the left, whereas the opposite is associated with the right. Well, my point, and I would describe myself as a kind of Tory socialist, my point has been that actually we think of these as very kind of discrete categories. You can't be on the right and be a very, you know, kind of rationalist materialist. But of course you can. And historically, if you look at the history of the Labour Party, and indeed the history of the Conservative Party, Martin Pugh's book on the history of the Labour Party makes the point that a lot of the early Labour Party figures were not necessarily liberal Methodist, you know, people who'd been supporters of Gladstone and were in favour of temperance and Methodism and all this kind of stuff.
All that kind of stuff
that George Orwell rightly objected to. Actually, a lot of the early Labour, particularly in the trade union movement, were kind of rambunctious John Bull, beer and, you know, bacon sandwiches kind of chaps. And actually, somewhere like Lancashire, for example, the early Labour Party often was in majorly in competition with the Tories, trying to make out that they were the more patriotic option and they'd protect your right, you know, to have a beer and a smoke and all this kind of thing, which obviously was the legacy of the Disraeli paternalism and kind of the mid to late 19th century. And so I just think that we think about these categories as very discrete, and that the natural progression of being like a kind of roundhead and then a Whig and then a liberal is then you're left and Labour and you want to call you. Actually, you can probably be a monarchist, you can love the Church of England, and you could also want a more fairer distribution of wealth and to look after the interests of the poor.
But before we go into the specifics, so that's a view very like Robert Toombs's view in his book about English history, where he basically says the great cleavage politically and culturally is exactly that, is between roundheads and being kind of nonconformists, do-gooding nonconformists, and John Bull kind of small T Tories, well, small C conservatives, I suppose, to some extent. And do you think is that basically your take, that there's on the one side Dr. Johnson, on the other side there's, I don't know, Nick Clegg, and you're kind of...
That's a very harsh...
you're one of the... Yeah, well,
Antinomy, you're setting up there.
You're Dr. Johnson or you're Sir Stafford Cripps, and never the twain shall meet kind of thing.
Yeah, I definitely think that is a kind of, I think it's actually related to personality to a large degree. I've always thought that, you know, people's politics is often determined by their personality by a lot more than we would like to admit. But I think it can interact with different kind of other axes, like, you know, whether you believe that the state should intervene, you know, your attitude to capitalism, basically. I mean, the great historian J.G.A. Pocock makes this point that, looking at Marxists in the kind of 20th century, that they kind of fall into two categories. One are kind of romantic conservatives who bewail the way that capitalism destroyed kind of popular traditions of solidarity and moral economy and so on, and the kind of liberal and the heirs to the kind of liberal rationalist tradition who saw Marxism as the natural development of the inevitable progressive course of history, and so on. And I think that's true. I think there's actually even amongst Marxists you get a kind of weird paternalism amongst some of them, that is almost aristocratic paternalism. I mean, look at Perry Anderson or someone like that, who's the New Left Review. I mean, he's like a landowning aristocrat from Ireland who is very paternalistic and almost kind of high Tory in some of his, weirdly. So actually, you know, these categories, although we think they're very clear, they intersect in some very odd ways.
Yeah, okay, so we can accept that the legacy of the civil wars in the 17th century have kind of percolated down through, you know, not just British history, American history as well, for centuries that have followed. But nevertheless, the conditions in the mid-17th century, in many ways, are very remote, very alien to us. So the question I would ask is, drawing your shining sword from the scabbard to defend the king and martyr. I mean, dare I ask, how much of a pose is this? And how much are you genuinely committed to the divine right of kings?
Well, I think I like to keep a healthy, tongue-in-cheek attitude to some of it. But I genuinely believe that Charles I is not anyone. It was a king of good intentions, a scrupulous administrator who attempted to do his best to defend the rights of the poor, a great cultural figure who patronised the arts, and in many ways not the absolutist or tyrant he's painted as. I think that he was a man who found himself facing very difficult circumstances. He found himself facing a potential war, constant calls for a war to vindicate his sister in the Palatinate, which Parliament would never probably fund. He inherited a war machinery that was very creaky from his father. He inherited a system where there was no real regular system of taxation. He inherited all kinds of and a rising, ever rising kind of Puritan hierarchy, Puritan sentiment in the country that was pretty unreasonable. I mean, if we had to deal with some of the frankly extremely kind of the lunatics in the Long Parliament, I think you'd get sick of them pretty quickly, because I said somebody on Twitter described them as a cross between Ian Paisley and the Taliban. And I think that's about right. They were very much into very harsh moral regulation of everyday life, trying to ban quite innocent pastimes and pleasures of the people. And Charles reissued the Book of Sports, which basically tried to allow the common people to have their ale and their maypoles on a Sunday and so on.
Tom, the Book of Sports.
Yeah, of course. Well, that's why I'm a floating voter.
If that's not Merry England, I don't know what is.
But the argument surely against Charles the First. Oh, go on, Tom, what are you going to say?
Well, yeah. No, I was going to, you, Dominic, yes. as the round head. The doctrinaire defender of regicide.
I'm not
the enthusiast for Cromwell.
I'm a cruel necessity man. I'm like Varys in Game of Thrones. I just believe in the stability of the realm. I would say, could you not say of Charles I? I mean, okay, Charles I's not a, he's not Pol Pot.
he's not Nero, is he?
No, he's not Nero. Although, as Ted said in the podcast, Nero was the analogy that people often reached for at the time, maybe unfairly. But
I think definitely
he,
unfairly.
He is. He gets a lot wrong. He's governing at a time of heightened passions because of the 30 Years' War. As you say, there's the sort of Puritan, it's easy for us to look back and to say that's kind of Puritan hysteria and stuff. But by the end of his personal rule, so when he dissolves Parliament at the end of the 1620s and then rules without Parliament throughout the 1630s, and that becomes sort of enshrined in Puritan Whig memory as tyranny. But there's no doubt that at the end of that rule, there are all sorts of grievances that have built up because of his taxation and so on, because of the kind of intrusion of royal government and royal authority. And then he plays his cards. He just keeps playing his cards politically very, very badly. Isn't that true?
Well, the fact that he ends up on the block suggests that clearly, realpolitik was not his strong point. And I agree that he definitely made tactical mistakes. I mean, trying to impose a new liturgy on the Scots and then trying to send an army to enforce it is in many ways the source of, is the kind of key hinge point where it all goes wrong.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been far more politic to allow the Presbyterian Scots to just continue the way they were, at least for the time being. I agree with that. But he made mistakes. I don't think that you could really deny that. But I think that often his mistakes were the outcome of the fact that he was a genuinely quite principled ruler who did believe in the common good of his subjects. And you have to bear in mind that the people who gather in the Long Parliament, who, put the Grand Remonstrance and so on, don't represent hugely, are not terribly representative of the population. They're very representative of the Puritan gentry, yes. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the majority of people in the country, to be honest, I expect many of the masses probably were pretty, indifferent to the religious debates, whether or not they knelt at communion or not, probably to a lot of them was somewhat indifferent. But I would make the point that if they had any view on the king, a lot of the common people, many of them probably were quite glad that they had somebody who actually his social policy, which he enforced through what was called the Book of Orders. And it was a very thorough attempt to make sure that local authorities genuinely paid attention to the interests of the poor. So he was famous for him and Laud, his great Lieutenant, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury.
You love Archbishop Laud, don't you?
I do. He's my hero. I mean, I think he's a great man.
So just tell us a bit about Archbishop Laud for the benefit of those who may never have heard of him.
Okay, so Archbishop Laud had been the Bishop of London, and Charles quickly promoted him to be Archbishop of Canterbury.
I mean, like Charles, he's very small, isn't he?
Yes. Well, I mean, my favourite fact about Laud is the fact that he kept a pet tortoise, which remained in the Lambeth Palace, where the Archbishop of Canterbury lived, well into the 18th century, as a kind of because this tortoise lived to be a fantastic age,
even longer than Richard Cromwell.
Yes, indeed, and so Laud, I think, had a view of the so. We've got to bear in mind, put this into the context of what happened in the previous century. The church, with the dissolution of the monasteries, had lost a lot of its wealth, a lot of its power, and it had lost a lot of its paternalistic impetus to, you know, the monastic institutions. The church was the welfare state, basically, of the Middle Ages, and a lot of it had been trashed by people, and the gentry and so on had taken their share, divided this loot between them, and hadn't really paid much attention to the interests of the poor. Hence, one of the things that Laud and Charles I are most famous for is opposing enclosures, where the common land of the people was taken into private ownership, and this often led to depopulation and the poorest really having a rough time of it, and people say this was because they wanted to raise fines and raise money because they needed money because they hadn't called a parliament, and there may be some element of truth to that. But if you look at the thoroughness, and indeed Laud's nickname was Thorough, so that's quite appropriate. If you look at the thoroughness of their social policy, they really paid a lot of attention to, for example, during times of dearth and unemployment, making sure that the kind of work schemes for the poor were put into practice to avoid unemployment. So they really did. I think that Laud, they had a kind of vision of social harmony and kind of a kind of paternalistic vision of social harmony, which I think is quite attractive.
Okay, I accept that. But just so that you're on here so that we can justify ourselves and make ourselves look good. You objected to Charles not being listed among in the World Cup of Kings and Queens. Would you not say that a king in a country that kind of is instinctively royalist, instinctively assumes that the monarchy stands at the heart of the way the country should be organized, ends up losing his head and having the monarchy abolished?
Yeah, after two civil wars.
After two civil wars. That this isn't a kind of crowning achievement. I mean, this is very much, you know, if you're a football manager, getting relegated.
Yeah. We played great football. Just didn't score any goals.
It's not great, is it?
Okay, so, I mean, part of my original point was to try to vindicate him from some of the more wilder accusations thrown against him by the likes of Mr. Valance. So this idea that, you know, he was kind of novel absolutist, which I just think is not true. But I accept, obviously, that ending up with your head on the block is not the ideal outcome for a monarch.
But there's surely, just quickly defend Ted on that, we didn't bring him on because it's not the Today programme and he's already served us manfully. But he would say, surely, and lots of historians would say, Charles is very strongly influenced by going to Spain when he tried to have his Spanish match and in the 1620s. And absolutism, or a greater kind of royal state, you know, with greater tax-raising powers, the greater displays of splendor, all that sort of stuff.
And art collections.
And art collections are obviously part of that. That is in the ether in the early 17th century. That is kind of, well, and throughout the 17th century generally, that is the novelty, that is the mood of the moment. And Charles does imbibe some of that, doesn't that stuff, doesn't he, from France and Spain and want to reproduce it in England?
I think when you look at the actual, real, substantial constitutional issues, however, that you know, it's not actually a very valid argument. So, for example, you know, what clearly happens in the kind of first half of the 17th century is you get the rise of a lot of ideas from common lawyers about ideas of the ancient constitution, and supposedly kind of libertarian, kind of freedom-loving constitution that supposedly existed in the Anglo-Saxon era, and this comes to define a lot of the discourse of the Long Parliament. And people like Edward Coke and people like that, and Pym and so on. And like, this is largely a massive innovation. Most of this ancient constitutionalist idea is there some kind of immemorial constitution which enshrines the rights of parliaments and so on? That's actually very innovative. And if you look at the 19 propositions, which are kind of one of the major triggers in 1642 of the actual civil war, all the claims being made for parliamentary authority have no precedents to defend them. Charles is the defender of precedent in his reply to the 19 propositions. I think that the problem is that we try to apply the standards of the post-Glorious Revolution era to Charles I, whereas it's much better to judge Charles I as a kind of last medieval, one of the last medieval monarchs. And he very scrupulously, if you look at Kevin Sharp's excellent book, The Personal Rule of Charles I, he attempts to show in some detail that almost all of the things that Charles I is identified with as somehow kind of innovatory and so on, actually have good precedents and are not particularly innovatory. And in fact, he was scrupulous to always present the legal precedents and to show actually this has been done before. Even the fact of ruling without a parliament is not that innovative. I mean, his father had ruled for 6 years without a parliament at one point. Elizabeth was always dissolving parliaments because of the pesky Puritans. I mean, it's not as innovative. He's not the big innovator that people make
out
when
you look at the- But they don't have civil wars against them. So that would suggest to me that something is different, because Elizabeth I does not provoke, you know, a civil war, nor does James I.
No, I agree. I think one of the things that does provoke the civil war, I mean, there are all kinds of factors. It's very complex, but one of the chief factors that provokes the civil war is the fact that because Charles has spent a long time, trying to partly to raise money for his personal rule because he doesn't have a parliament to give him money. But then again, the parliaments of the 1620s had been very stingy. And actually they had, for example, refused him customary rights like tonnage and poundage and so on. And when he was trying to vindicate the rights of the Protestant cause in Europe, and they weren't terribly, they were all for the Protestant cause, so long as they didn't actually have to pay for it. I think that when you look at the parliaments, they are, you know, they're often extremely unreasonable. But I understand that. But one of the main factors is you have a rise of very extremist Presbyterians and other independents and so on, who are very. He did suffer very, very difficult circumstances.
Just on that, can I read you this? I'm just going to read you this. This is from Mark Kishlansky, a historian you all know, on the 17th century. He says, Charles's efforts at centralizing his monarchies were successful within the constraints of 17th century inefficiencies, but they did not come without cost. He placed the implicit partnership between the crown and the social and political elites under severe stress. There was a widespread malaise towards the end of the 1630s that Charles and those who advised him could not be trusted. And this lack of confidence was shared by local magistrates, peers of the realm, even by central office holders. So there was something gone wrong.
I agree with that. What I'll say is that, yes, he did make himself quite unpopular amongst a lot of the local elites. But you have to ask yourself the question, why did they hate what he was doing so much? And often what they hated was the fact that he was trying to reel them in from a lot of rather unpleasant things that we wouldn't think, you know, from certainly from a modern perspective, we wouldn't have much time for.
You genuinely see Charles I as
people's king.
Yeah, the chief champion of the people.
I see him
against
as
the powerful.
A paternalistic father of his people, trying to defend them against the degradations of the Puritan elite and the merchant classes and the gentry classes who wanted to exploit the common people. I think this is read Kevin Sharp's book, and there's genuinely, this does come back to bite him, of course, because when the Long Parliament is called, a lot of these people who are elites and they're powerful elites in the country have been very much. There's no doubt that they are very discontented by the time the Long Parliament's called, and things quickly as they often do in revolutions, things radicalise very quickly. And as a result of that, you do find quite a few of the people who in 1640 were actually quite critical of the king rally to the royal standard, quite quickly in 1642. So, I mean, Clarendon, for example, who is the famous historian of the Great Rebellion, who was one of the king's chief advisors, and then later,
Wiltshire man.
Yes, he was actually quite critical of Charles in the first Parliament. But when he realised just how radical and kind of mad a lot of the Puritans in Parliament were, he soon thought, I'm not sure about this, and rallied to the cause of the king and moderate more. And when the king had kind of conceded a more constitutionalist kind of approach, and if Charles innovated, it was because he accepted some of the premises of the radicals when he accepted in his reply to the 19 propositions. So,
okay. You know,
I agree that, and then he did make some mistakes in the short term. So, you know, I think his wife didn't help a lot of the time.
No.
Well,
political leaders with wives causing trouble. Fortunately, we've moved on from that. Just to stick up for our podcast, which is really what this is all about. I think that the core argument of those two episodes was that Charles, his character, made his execution inevitable. That he was kind of obdurate. He refused to negotiate. He was seen by his opponents as untrustworthy, and that brought him to the block. But that his courage, his readiness to accept death as bravely as he did, in the long run, kind of won him a kind of victory. And that doesn't seem to me to be implicitly, you know, an anti-Caroline argument. I would have thought that would be an argument that you might conceivably able to agree with Ted about.
He didn't get that far in the podcast talk because he threw his headphones across the room.
Of course he did, yes.
I actually subsequently listened to both of the podcasts. And I will concede that the second podcast particularly was fairer and had some, you know, more substantial arguments. I agree with that. But what my real issue was the whole presentation of the kind of setup and the background, which is always presented as that was my issue, not so much the I may just slightly add one thing is that the reason why, you know, people say he was untrustworthy in the 1640s and he wouldn't compromise. Well, he didn't compromise because for him, one of the central questions of the episcopacy was not something you can compromise on. It's a question of apostolic succession, and it's a question of a deeply held religious conviction, and that's why we Anglicans of a certain disposition, that's why we treat him as a martyr. Because he died for the cause of
did you hear the bonus episode that followed?
I have not yet listened to it.
Oh, you must listen to that, because we talk about a service held at St. Bartholomew the Great in London.
Yes, under Marcus Walker.
With Marcus Walker. So we do touch on that. There's one other thing that I just wanted to ask you before we end, which is on a similar theme, prompted by the Platinum Jubilee of Elizabeth II. And that is that she... it does seem, regards her coronation oath as something sacramental, dare I say sacral.
Oh, Tom, for God's sake.
That she sees herself as, you know, anointed, God's anointed. And obviously that's how Charles saw himself. It's not a perspective that most people today, I would guess, in Britain have, even the most committed royalists. But is that your personal conviction?
Yes. I mean, I think that when we see the coronation of the next monarch, which, I mean, God willing, will be a long time yet, but it's clearly not going to be in the too terribly distant future. People are going to realise that, you know, we still anoint the monarch, and that is a symbol of God's, choosing of the next monarch and so on. And indeed, that won't be televised because it's such a sacral moment that it wasn't deemed to be something that could be shown on television. I think a lot of people are going to get a bit of a shock when they realise that this is still in our coronation ceremonies and oaths. And I think that. In an age where politicians, elected politicians of all stripes, are so unpopular and seem so self-interested and seem so kind of grubbing around for their own corrupt interests, the idea of having a monarch who sails above it all and, you know, has the kind of providential kind of order embodied in them, that's a very attractive prospect. And I'm not calling for the restitution of absolute or medieval monarchy now, but I do think that the monarchy it will only become stronger as we realise that we need a focus for national unity and something in common and a sense of a common good that transcends in party interests and factional interests. And in that sense, although it may not manifest itself in constitutional reversion to the 17th century, it nonetheless it still resonates. And I hope and I look forward to watching the coronation of King Charles III.
And just
one last final thing. I named my son Charles after the king and martyr. So I'm looking forward on his behalf to a new era of Caroline divinity and cultural renovation. And hopefully we can return to the glory years of the personal rule.
Well, so Dominic, what do you think? Should we have him executed or should we let him off with a warning?
I don't know, because I think there was a lot of stuff about the podcast in general being infected with Whiggery. I don't think I'm very Whiggish. I think Tom is very Whiggish. You are very Whiggish, aren't you, Tom?
Yeah, I'm unapologetic.
Tom, Dr. Johnson would think you were vile.
Yeah, but although one of my most Whiggish features is that Dr. Johnson is my great hero. So I'm so centrist dad.
Yeah.
That even though I'm a Whig, I love Dr. Johnson.
I don't think I'm a Whig. Do you think I'm a Whig, Capel?
Well, actually, I mean, I've read your modern histories of Britain, and actually you often resist this temptation to... Basically, it's the Puritans of the 17th century are a kind of radical elite, progressive elite,
yeah. who,
and we always focus on what they were thinking, when actually the majority were not very interested. And this is a very similar dynamic to the 60s, when you have, you know, all the cultural elites think everyone were listening to the Rolling yes. Stones and the Beatles and so on. But actually, you know...
we're going to end this now.
this is getting good. What do you mean?
No, and now we'll be on to kind of dissing John Lennon before you say anything. Wasn't
John Lennon was a vile hellhound, if anyone
yeah,
was.
Yeah, he was a vile hellhound.
Okay. I think
Lennon, Wolf, no. Balance.
The trinity of the hell, yeah. trinity of hellhounds. Vile.
The unholy trinity.
Okay, well, Capital Loft, I feel that you have spoken enough. I'm going to let you off. I'm not going to chop your ears off.
I think you've acquitted yourself quite well, actually.
You have.
It's a sort of blockbuster style scenario with one of you against two of us.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to vindicate the honour of Charles King and Martha. I appreciate it.
You've done
much.
It incredibly well.
And I hope I will have attracted lots of new royalist listeners to your show.
All those Anglican royalists out there. I mean, there's so many. It's just an untapped market.
Well, but you know the problem now is that we're going to get loads of radical Republicans saying, vile, that hellhound Capital Loft. There was a comment on Twitter from Dick of Axe talking about you, Capital Loft. Surely, and our invitation to you to come on this, surely this will just encourage other wangs to slag off the show. P.S. I think I could do a much better Neanderthal impression of Boney M. Just saying. Dick of Axe, no, this is not going to happen. This is very much a one-off. So please don't just start dissing us just for the sake of it, thinking you're going to get on the show, because that's not how it's going to work. Is it, Dominic?
It's not. But we should say thank you very much for being such a good sport. And
thank you.
I know you tweeted a picture of all the reading you were doing to prepare. And I don't think we've tapped the. I fear no. that we haven't probably tapped the.
No, we could have a. You know, could go on for years, like Charles's tyranny.
Personal rule.
Personal rule.
Right. On that note, thank you so much for coming on.
And thank you very much.
And keep listening.
Okay, so Capital Loft has been led away. He's not going to the stocks. He's not going to the block.
Life imprisonment rather than a capital sentence, surely.
And Dominic, that leaves us time just very quickly to go through some stuff that people have been saying on Discord.
Yes. There's some shocking stuff here. Some shocking stuff,
Tom. A lot of excitement about pigeons. Gordon Carrero is going to be coming on talking about pigeons. You were contemptuous of this, but the people have spoken. The wangs want it.
I think the wangs are being ironic, Tom.
I don't think they are.
I think they're being flippant with you. I think they're teasing you.
So anyway, well, G Norden, if the pigeon episode goes ahead, it will be going ahead. The remarkably swift extinction of the passenger pigeon would be an interesting topic. It would.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And of course, the dodo is also a pigeon. So
is it?
Yeah.
Well, it was. I mean, not anymore.
It was. So that I'm sure will feature in the thing. And then the kingfish wang. It just occurred to me that pigeons could be rather nasty vectors for disease.
People liked the disease episodes, didn't they? I mean, but they were...
I thought they were brilliant.
They were really, really interesting.
I loved his book.
I learned so much from him and from his book. And Lurky,
such a great interviewee, I thought.
Yeah, he was a very good interviewee.
His speaking style gives a very good sense of his writing style.
Well, we've
articulate and
we've recorded two episodes, haven't we, with him? Two episodes?
Yeah.
For two episodes about the disease in Rome and the fall of Rome. So that's look forward to. So Lurkio said of the disease that the episodes remind me of what to my mind is a bias in history, to report history as decided by human agency. So, you know, he gives his example, he says the Black Death, you know, it's only given a walk-on part in the history of the medieval world, but it obviously was utterly transformative. I think that's actually, I think there's a lot of truth in that. So the Black Death in all the kind of, when you're a child and you're doing the Middle Ages, the Black Death gets basically a page or two pages.
Yeah, well, Lurkio gives a wonderful parody of, and now we come to the mid-14th century, the Black Death. Anyway, in 1350, which is kind of...
It is, yeah, it is.
So even in A Distant Mirror, Barbara Tuchman's great book on at the impact of the Black Death on Europe, actually, it only has a chapter, and then it is kind of, well, anyway, back to the Battle of Poitiers.
It is like that, isn't it? It's a bit like writing a history of Hiroshima in 1945 and saying there was... That summer, there was a terrible bombing. Meanwhile, the local football team was. I mean, you're right.
But that's why I thought it was, you know, a paradigm shifting series of episodes, because it did show how, you know, until really a century and a half ago, perhaps, you know, even a century ago, infectious diseases, everything.
Well, he has that amazing fact, doesn't he? That has really stuck in my mind, that there have been 10,000 human generations, And for all three. But the last three, yeah, infectious disease was the biggest killer. And
you don't know until you see it, and that's what COVID, the impact of COVID has kind of revealed. I mean, imagine if we're living not just with COVID, but multitudes of diseases that are even worse.
Smallpox,
all the time.
Cholera, Spanish flu. All the time. Yeah. Barry Grogan was very pleased by the talk of dysentery. I thought that was fascinating, actually, that dysentery was such a big killer, because so many medieval kings and Roman emperors die of the flux or some such, don't they? And you're like, God, what a banal way to end. What a strange, but obviously it's not to the people at the time. That's a perfectly legitimate way to end your life. I mean, that's what happened.
But also, I mean, he had, four children. I mean, anyone who's had children or indeed has been a child. will remember what a kind of crucial part just, the toilets are.
Yes. Oh yeah. God. I mean,
How important that the way that people become shorter and shorter. If you're a child in that kind of environment, fighting off the effects of dysentery explains why you end up much shorter.
When we went to when our son was about 8 months old, we went to America for a wedding to California, and then we went on a road trip. And before we left, I created an enormous Word document with details of toilets, basically every toilet on the West Coast of America, because I knew we would need, we would just, and you forget that later on, but obviously for presumably most people who've ever lived.
Well, Joyce saw that as very British.
Did he?
Yeah, obsession with toilets. Equated it with British and Roman imperialism.
That's what made us great, right? I mean,
that was the implication.
Yeah.
And then a comment from Medusa the Gorgon, which is very topical because I was made to watch Percy Jackson a couple of nights ago by my daughters.
Okay, is it good?
And it features Uma Thurman as Medusa.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Imagine Uma Thurman with kind of hissing snakes.
Yeah.
Medusa Gorgon says, I finally watched the very British Scandal, then listened to the Jeremy Thorpe podcast again. I think if the club had started then, we'd all be called bunnies. And bunnies can and will go to France. So the Wangs dodged a bullet there.
Yeah, they did. I mean, especially if you were going to greet them with your Hugh Grant voice.
And then there's something from GF. Oh, no, I don't think we need this.
Oh, yeah. No, he's been reading White Heat by Stanley Baldwin.
No, we don't need this. No, let's. Okay, I think that's enough. So we'll see you next week.
Well, one last thing, Tom.
No, go on, read it, Dom.
No. I'm not going to read it.
I thought you would. So G.F. Noonan, somewhat random note, reading White Heat by Stanley Baldwin inspired me to watch Tom Jones. It is an unalloyed delight. Yes, it is. Oh, as is Dominic's book, of course.
Thank you, G.F. Noonan. Mm. I was actually going to say, Mary Kirk Alves has created this amazing map showing where all the Rest Is History members are from. So it's a sort of map of the globe with pins in. As Richard H. says, the sun never sets on the Rest Is History Club. So you can find the map on the Discord and you can presumably put your own pin in or you can tell her where you're from. And that way we will know where you live and we can then stop pestering you with spam.
And on that note, goodbye.
Bye-bye.